We all know how important relationships in life are. We have family relationships, mother, father, children, and so on. And of course, in my family right now, we are reminded of those relationships since my mother just passed away. But it's a blessing. It was just 4 months ago that my father passed away. Both of them were in their 90s, and they had spent their lives well, and they were ready to go. And so we are rejoicing in that. But that relationship continues in that we hold that dear, as we do with all of our family members. We have relationships with neighbors, those close to us, near and far. We have work relationships, employer, employee, co-workers, all of those. We have casual relationships, people we see walking in our neighborhoods, working, whatever. I recall there was a couple that used to walk in our neighborhood a long time ago. Their names were Dave and Evelyn. I could remember the name Dave pretty easily, fortunately. But one time they were walking, and he was wearing this particular hat, and I was walking by, and I just said to him, "I like your hat." And he took it off, and he gave it to me. So I wasn't saying I wanted your hat. I just said, "I liked your hat." He said, "That's okay. You can have it. You might want to wash it, but you can have my hat." So I still have that hat. If you want to see it, I'll show you sometime. But that was a casual relationship. Kind of got to know them a little bit over the process of time. It's been years since they've been around. They've long gone. They were up in their years already by that point. But that was a casual relationship. That was kind of an interesting one. Kind of miss Dave and Evelyn. It's been a while. Close friend relationships. Those that we hold dear, those that are close. Could be in a variety of contexts. We have perhaps undesirable relationships, people that we do not like. Can't imagine, but it's possible. Actually, I can imagine. I'm sure it's too realistic, and there are unpleasant relationships, people who do not like us. Sometimes it's mutual as well. And there may even be some enemies in the process. That's a relationship, but it's not a good one. So there's a variety of kinds of things. So relationships, I mean, you think about it, they're all kinds. And it's kind of a defining factor in life, relationships. We get our greatest joys from relationships. I can't help but think of certain little ones that come to mind, especially when they say, "I love you, Papa." And they have that big smile and those cute eyes. It's like, wow. We also get our greatest frustrations out of relationships. We can take a good relationship and we can mess it up pretty easily by a misstep or a misstatement. And then we have to try to fix it. We all know how unpleasant it is to be on the outs with someone. As Christians, we know how critical it is to be rightly related to God through faith in Christ. That's a critical relationship that we want to have and foster. We also know that many relationships are defining in the matter of basic associations. Who are you associated with? You may be associated with a particular group. And you will be either included or excluded by another group because you're associated with that. That's a relationship as well. I mean, we know this is especially true in our politically polarized world today. If you're in one group, then you're pretty much antithetical and maybe on the outs with somebody in another group. And you can think of a lot of different places where that fits. As Christians, we are directly identified by our associations. And Christians are commonly viewed as exclusivist bigots with deficient intellectual capacity. Did I really say that? That's how we are viewed by some, increasingly, unfortunately. Christians are now more and more identified as being morally deficient due to our stands on various social matters. We are the problem. We are being called immoral for holding to biblical values and biblical truth. That's hard to take when we see. This is what the Bible says. This is God's word. This is what we know to be true. How can you be saying that? So being a Christian essentially leaves us with a strained relationship with the world. How are we to think about that? So we want to deal with the matter of separation from the world. Looking at verses 17 through 19 of John chapter 15. These things I command you, that you love one another. This is just a summary statement of what had happened before, but it's kind of helpful to keep it in view because he's going to move into something else. Because he's talking about love and then he's talking about hate. These things I command you, that you love one another. If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So our association with Christ alienates us from the world. The summary command to love one another introduces the contrast of the world's response to us. Our love for one another should be in clear contrast to the lack of love from the world. And this text is telling us, don't be surprised. Be prepared. Recognize. This is the way it's going to be. Our love for one another should help us deal with the lack of love from the world. That's why the disciples were being told this, and it carries on to us as well. We need to be loving one another because we're not going to get it from the world. So we need to care for one another. We need each other's love to help us cope with our alienation from the world. The basis of our love for one another is Christ's love for us. We do not generate our love for one another from our own determination. It's not simply a matter of the will. There's more to it than that. We generate love for one another from responsive hearts to Christ's love for us. That's the emphasis that's noted here. It's the overflow of our loving response to his love for us. And we need Christ's love to motivate us to love each other, because our natural inclination is to love ourselves over others. And so we recognize that. Our relationship with Christ alienates us from the world. Devotion to Christ takes us in the opposite direction from the world because it has to do with worldview and affections, our priorities, interests, investments, what we give ourselves to. And this puts a target on our back so that we are viewed as enemies of the world. And that is becoming more and more evident. And it's becoming stated as such by many who readily identify us in a negative way. So our relationship with Christ directs the world to hate us, essentially. So we need to keep that in mind because we have to deal with that. I mean, it's not easy to think that the world does not like us. Because we like us. It reminds me of when the missionary family, the Junkers, and we still have contact with them, stayed at our house, and the little one at the time, trying to remember which name it was, but anyway, he was not even 2 years old, and he was sitting next to Emily, and he said to Emily, "I love me. Do you love me?" It was adorable, but it does remind us of the fact that we kind of do love each love ourselves, and that's kind of how it works. Our relationship with Christ directs the world to hate us, but Christ chose us out of the world to be in it, but not of it. So devotion to Christ requires a commitment to Him that is in direct opposition to the world, pretty much in every area of life. So we should remember the importance of loving one another in the face of a hostile world around us. And we should encourage and help each other to stay on track. And so we might not want to say, "I love me, do you love me?" We could just say, "I love you. Regardless of whether you love me, but I hope you do." Our associations with the world may alienate us from Christ. This is a matter of mindset and affiliations, being of the world. Because the reality is we have to have some connections with the world that we live in. We must live somewhere. We need to buy things in order to live. We need to deal with people who live in and love the world. And so we can't go out of the world. We have to be in it. So we need to keep our perspective with the world. There are many things to enjoy and appreciate being in the world, whether it be areas of entertainment or sports or arts or outdoor activities or on and on. There are things that we can enjoy, but we can't be consumed by the world. There needs to be an element of balance. And it may vary for different people as to what they can or cannot deal with or tolerate, because there are certain gray areas that are not as defined. But so we need to ask ourselves, what do I need to know, or how do I handle my connection with the world? Where can I have a connection, and to what degree, so that it doesn't affect me negatively? That's something that we all have to deal with. The more we embrace of the world, the more it embraces us. We have been warned not to love the world. You may remember 1 John 5:15 through 17. Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. That's kind of intending to help us put things in perspective. We probably don't need to give a whole lot of definition to what is involved there, because we can see, we know what being of the world is. It's all around us. We're immersed in it. It's like an amoeba. It seeks to envelop us. But we need to be conscious of it so that we're not overtaken in the process. Because we know something of the power and the influence of the world on a soul. 1 John 4:5 says, "They are of the world, therefore they speak as of the world, and the world hears them." And it's easy to be taken in, and many have been. We can feel the oppression and feel the pull of it, and we have to be conscious of it and seek to resist it, to recognize it, so that we're not overtaken. The less we embrace, the less of the world we embrace, the less it embraces us. Our resistance to the world has practical implications. The more we resist the world, the more it resists us. It doesn't want us to go the way of following Christ. And we should be concerned if the world does embrace us. If the world fully accepts us, then guess what? We're of the world. we're not of Christ, or we're not acting as though we are. And if we do resist the world, we can expect rejection, even persecution. We have the resources to resist the influence of the world. 1 John 5, 4 and 5 says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. Who is he who overcomes the world, but he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God?" And so we have the resources in him. If we are a believer, we have Christ in us. We have the Holy Spirit indwelling us. We are submissive to his word, or at least we ought to be. So how are we doing at personally overcoming the world and resisting? It's largely mental. It's a mindset. It's a worldview. There is a need for the church corporately to resist the world as well as individually. And the world is trying to influence us, but we're called to influence the world. So we've got to somehow turn that around. Remember James chapter 4, verse 4, "Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God." So, are we friends of the world, or are we friends of God? Is there a distinction between the world and the church that is getting clearer or getting muddier? Is the church getting more like the world, or is the world getting more like the church? Well, that's not a hard question to answer. It would seem that the separation should be getting clearer, but it may not be. But with that in mind, if we're supposed to have a sort of separation in mindset, we can't not connect with the world because we're called to reach the world. So at the same time, we need to have an outreaching mentality to reach out to the world. So that puts us in a rather tricky spot. That's why we need to love one another. We need that encouragement. We need to hang together so that we can be resisting the influence of the world, but provide an influence to the world that is Christ-like. Then there is identification with the Master, verses 20 and 21. "Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me." They are not believers, is the idea. The principle: the servant is identified with his master. A servant is a representative of his master. He is a practical actor in behalf of the master. Someone may be a representative of a company. My second oldest brother was a representative for a lumber company for many years in Michigan. He has just since retired, but he spoke in behalf of, he represented the company. And someone may be a representative for a group of people. We have a representative form of government, at least theoretically. Doesn't always look or act that way, but that's how it's supposed to work. An ambassador has a similar function, to represent a nation. And it involves one person acting in behalf of another. And as followers of Christ, that is what we are to be, to act in his behalf. We are his hands and his feet on earth to serve him. So, as a representative of the master, we are to be practical actors in his behalf. But there's also a sense in which a servant is a representation of his master, a visible icon. We're all familiar with icons these days because we have them on our phones and computers and everything else. Such people serve in behalf of another person or group. It's kind of evident in some of the parables, Luke 20:9-11. Then he began to tell the people this parable. A certain man planted a vineyard, leased it to vine dressers, and went to a far country for a long time. Now at vintage time, he sent a servant to the vine dressers that they might give him some of the fruit of the vineyard, but the vine dressers beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent another servant, and they beat him also, treated him shamefully, and sent him away empty-handed. These servants were representatives, but they were also a representation of him, and so they were mistreated as though they were the person that they were representing. Now, you've probably thought about this, but a servant, let's use the word worker in our context, is the first face you see for a company. There are some interesting things to think about that. If you go to McDonald's, that may not be your favorite place unless you have small children, but I've been there a few times, and it was usually with the grandkids because that's where they wanted to go. But you get a flavor for the place based on who it is that you meet. And they can be wonderful or they can be not so wonderful. And you are kind of led to ask, are they properly trained to represent the company? Do they realize how important their position is? Do they realize that they are, in fact, a representative of the company that they work for? And likewise, we need to remember we are representatives of Christ, and we, by the virtue of being Christians, are sort of an icon of representation for our Master. What kind of an icon are we? Do we make him look good or do we make him look bad? Then there's the practice. The servant will be treated like the master. There is a carryover of mistreatment. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. Our association with Christ makes us vulnerable, because we're identified with him, we're associated with him as Christians. Christ is a lightning rod. You either love him or hate him. You really can't be neutral. He demands a response, and so you have to, in some way, respond. That's why people so strongly react to the mention of his name, unless it's used in vain, which we're familiar with as well. There's a carryover of responsiveness. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. The idea seems to be that if some people in the world follow Jesus' teaching, some would also follow his disciples' teaching. Doesn't always happen that way, but that can be the case. If we are representatives of him and we communicate his word, there should be a responsiveness as though it were to him. That, I think, is the intention. And so our objective is to get a positive response as we represent Christ. And so we work toward that end. But we don't always get that response. The root of response is one's relationship with God. Verse 21 says, "But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me." An unbeliever does not know God, and he acts as though he doesn't know God, doesn't care. Our identification with the Master has implications. And so we should expect the world to respond to us as it did to Christ and to his name, and try not to take it personally when they respond that way. Now, we know that, but we need to be reminded of that, because our inclination is to take it personally, and this is telling us, no, you don't have to take it personally. It's really about him. You're just representing him. Then there is accountability for the sinner. Looking first at verses 22 through 24. If I had not come and spoken to them, they would have no sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin. In other words, his personal presence with them had great significance. He who hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin. But now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father. What is the point that's being communicated here? Well, let's think about the problem of knowledge or truth and rejection. A specific standard is necessary in order to define deviation. You have to know where the line is. You can't declare something out of bounds if there are no boundaries. That's why if you go to a ball game, usually sometime before the game starts, they put fresh chalk to let you know very clearly where the boundaries are, because that's important. And you can't call something sin without law boundaries, without something defining it. That's the point. Christ is the only standard for truth and righteousness. He existed before the world began in triunity. He created the world and all that's in it. He is the Word, the Logos of God, the divine communication. So he communicates and speaks for God in that way. He is the standard of truth presented in Revelation. John 14:6 comes to mind. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. The law was given to Israel as a standard of behavior, and in the process it defined any deviation from sin. So you have to have something that gives definition. He is perfect in holiness and completely righteous. He is the ultimate standard by which all is evaluated, because he is the creator of the universe. His presence provides a clear standard to indicate sin. When he is there, the standard is even more evident and obvious. Therefore, when he's present on the earth, his standard was the measure for all men, and it made man's sin evident because the standard was there. I mean, it's like when you go into the airport and you're carrying your carry-on luggage, and just before you get on the plane, there's this little box thing, and you're supposed to be able to put your luggage in it without having to mash it too much to get it to fit. That's the standard. That's the picture that's, again, communicated here, and we need to keep that in mind as well. So it's talking about not our sin nature in this point. It's talking about a specific act, and in this context, it's talking about rejection. Because Christ is right there. How can you reject him? He is the standard. How can you reject the one who's right in front of you? So he's talking about accountability for rejection. Rejecting the physical presence made them directly accountable. And rejecting his works made them accountable. Verse 24. They rejected him even after personally seeing him and seeing his works. So those who were present with him and still rejected him, that put them in a very clear place of accountability. And that would be a very unpleasant place to be when reckoning comes. That verses 23 and 24 again. He who hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin, but now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father. the problem of relational integration. Because we have the Father and the Son that are intimately related. And we could throw the Spirit in there too because we're talking Trinity. But the focus here is on the Father and the Son. The nature of the Trinity broadens the infraction. One's response to Christ has implications for the Father, because to reject Christ effectively rejects the Father. And the question that we would want to ask is, do present-day Jews realize how serious that is? If they're rejecting Christ, they're rejecting the Father, they would not want to be guilty of rejecting the Father. Our loyalty or rejection applies to each person of the Godhead. And it, again, indicates the importance of knowing truth. We need to know what is true and who is true. The unity in the Godhead has broad implications. It cannot be ignored without consequences. There are three persons in one essence. We need to accept the truth of triunity of God, and it amplifies our accountability for acceptance or rejection, because you're not just rejecting one person, you're rejecting all. The unity of the Godhead cannot be fully understood either. So that makes it a little bit more complicated, because we have a finite understanding. We can't grasp. We're not omniscient like God is. But I suppose you already knew that. We're limited by our finite nature. We're not made of the same substance or nature as God. And there is this clear creator-creature distinction. Even though we're made in the image of God, we're still distinct, and we are limited, and He is not. So we have to accept His greatness, and we have to accept our limitations. Just a few texts to indicate this. Psalm 145:3, "Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised, and His greatness is unsearchable." Or Isaiah 40, verse 28, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable." Romans 11:33, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out." Ephesians 3:8, "To me, who am less than the least of all the saints, this grace was given that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ." So it's important for us to have a right view of God, and there's a lot of confusion here. And the nature of the Trinity can be a bit of a challenge for some. There was somebody who used to attend our Awana program some years ago, and even attended here for a little bit, but he did not accept the Trinity in our discussions. Was not able to be convinced of the need to, just didn't accept it. And so if you don't accept the Trinity, then you come up with something else, and it can't be right. Because you're going to neglect one aspect or another of the totality of Scripture. So we need to accept it as biblical truth, regardless of whether we can fully understand it. And it is difficult to see how all of the elements fit together, but when we realize that we are finite creatures, and there are just some things that we are unable to grasp, just like we are unable to see certain light waves, we are unable to hear certain sounds because of our limitations, even though there are other ways of measuring them, doesn't mean they don't exist. And just because we're not able to understand every element of the Trinity doesn't mean it's not able to be understood if you had the wherewithal to do so, which at this point we do not. But we may in glory. So it's indicated as truth, and we need to accept it. And we need to recognize the implications of that and think about the relational integration that is part of that equation. Then the last verse to consider today, verse 25. But this happened that the word might be fulfilled, which is written in their law. They hated me without a cause. This is talking about the breadth of personal accountability. There is accountability by knowledge, exposure to truth, and to a person, in this sense, who is the truth, includes accountability to that truth. The people of Jesus' day had revealed truth. They had their law. And they had ample predictions of the Messiah's coming. They were not without witness to the truth. But Jesus came as the living word, the living communication from God, the embodiment of truth. So his presence with them was very weighty. They should have acknowledged, they should have recognized, they had reason to do so, but they just didn't get it. Which is hard to imagine, because we would all think, hey, if Jesus showed up, that would be great, if we could be in his presence. Wouldn't we know it? How could you miss it? I mean, isn't there like a glow or something? Well, that's how we imagine it. Interesting to think about. But his presence with them and their personal rejection made them directly and personally accountable. And we need to be careful that we understand what that means. To be that close to the truth and still reject him. Because we can run into people who are like that. Hopefully we have not been in that situation. Or if we have, that we have come to recognize him. There is accountability by knowledge. And there is accountability by design. Conscience. We have a conscience. We are created in the image of God. And as human beings created in the image of God, we are capable of communication and communion with God. As humans created in the image of God, we have an innate God consciousness that can be cultivated or suppressed. Given all that God has done for us, in spite of our sinful, fallen state, we should be eager to be responsive to God. We should accept his truth. We should accept his son. Yet there are many who find it too hard to accept God's truth and his son, and they are held accountable for it. Truth can cause one to respond in faith or to harden in unbelief. We can accept Christ and align ourselves with him, or we can reject Christ and align ourselves with the world. Oh, but there's one more option. We can accept Christ and still align ourselves with the world. This is encouragement for us not to do that, lest we be a contradiction. And so we may want to think about, well, how closely am I aligned with Christ compared to how closely I'm aligned with the world? Is there a clear delineation in my own mind and in my own heart in this regard? The bottom line is we will either have a strained relationship with the world or we will have a strained relationship with Christ. And which do you have? Where are we? And it may be, well, depends what day. Some days we do pretty well. Other days maybe not quite so much. Where do we want to be? We are accountable for how we relate to Christ. How are we going to deal with that?